It was approximately 6 weeks ago that Minnesota Senator Eugene McCarthy published a book entitled The Limits of Power, in which he sounded a warning to the people and government of the United States that great nations throughout history have had a tendency to overestimate the prerogatives to which eminent military strength has entitled them. 1 week later, Senator McCarthy launched a quiet but forceful assault on Johnson administration policies in Asia, taking as his cue his own dictum that the possession of great power demands judicious exercise of it, lest that power itself be allowed to generate an irreversible momentum. In the past 5 weeks, McCarthy has carefully and thoughtfully clarified his position for the American public in a series of major speeches in Los Angeles, Boston, Chicago, and the Twin Cities. He believes the president has been led into a maze in Asia, enticed by the prospect of a decisive military victory in Vietnam that would, with one stroke, create stability in a generally unstable situation and set a convincing example of free world resoluteness for a militant, restless communist China. He has not accused the president of exercising faulty judgment, at least not directly, but he has indicated that he believes the president, urged on by Dean Rusk and Robert McNamara and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has ventured so far into the Asian maze that he cannot tell whether he is closer to the entrance or to the exit. And that fact alone, the senator maintains, is cause enough for serious reconsideration of the American commitment in Asia. More specifically, he views the war in Vietnam as strategically unnecessary, politically unsound, economically debilitating, and morally unjustifiable. By such circumstances, he says, are the collapses of great nations brought about. Senator McCarthy is not the only public figure who have taken issue with the president over the country's involvement in Vietnam, but he is the only member of the president's party to have turned the issue taking into a major political challenge. While he has not yet formally declared his intentions, the senator has indicated that he will enter a number of Democratic preferential primary elections early next year in order to give the voters of the states in question a viable alternative to Mr. Johnson as the Democratic nominee for president in 1968. He believes that the people of the United States now regret their involvement in the war in Vietnam and that they should be able to express their dissatisfaction with current policy without having to resort to voting for a Republican candidate or seeking out a third party which will better represent their views. The Democratic Party clearly is in a quandary over McCarthy's behavior. Many party functionaries in elected office, appointed office, or within the party organization earnestly side with the president. Others, many others, judging from their own statements on the war issue, find themselves privately supporting McCarthy. But the latter are uneasy, for McCarthy is not made of common political cloth. He is quiet, intellectual, not given to jumping into the political pork barrel feet first. He is not what is known as a party man, that is, one who gets involved in intra-party politicking. But he is a party man in the larger sense, one who believes that the Democratic Party, as a repository for a public philosophy, is the best political organization now functioning in the country. Because of this attitude and the posture it gives him in public life, McCarthy represents a risk for those politicians who might follow him in seeking, if not a change in party leadership, at least a change in administration policy. For should they back him and lose, they can expect little mercy and absolutely no favors from a triumphant Lyndon Johnson who plays the American political game in deadly earnest. As the editors of the New Republic put it in the November 18th issue of the magazine, professional politicians will be the last to cut loose from their leader, meaning Johnson, however unhappy they may be privately, either with Johnson's Asian policies or the handicap that his candidacy imposes on their own survival. They will transfer their allegiance only when it has been shown that someone else is able to do better than Johnson for them and for the party. Regardless of what that says about the quality of American political life, and it says volumes, the fact is that Eugene McCarthy is fighting an uphill battle against an entrenched administration. But he is not unaware of the odds against him, and he is not unarmed. To his struggle, he brings intelligence, wit, and a keen sense of the stakes involved for this country in Vietnam. For that reason, if no other, he deserves the attention of all Americans. They may not agree with him, but they cannot ignore the challenge he has posited. KUOM now presents, therefore, Minnesota Senator Eugene McCarthy as he spoke last weekend at the Conference on International Affairs at McAllister College in St. Paul.
I assume that many of you have been reading the analyses of my character and ego in recent days. I find that there are a lot of amateur psychiatrists, or perhaps they're real psychiatrists, masquerading as columnists in America. We had something of this experience in the hearing of the Foreign Relations Committee last year when we asked psychiatrists to come in and talk about foreign policy, at least in their own terms, and we found, as one writer said, the psychiatrists didn't want to talk psychiatry, they wanted to talk politics, and all the senators wanted to talk psychiatry. So I've given the columnists the chance to develop, at least to present a new field of their knowledge. And it's, I suppose one could profit from it. I anticipate that in the months ahead, some of them may go even deeper into my ego, and you back here will know what you've had in Washington from Minnesota for nearly 20 years. I have as my general topic the question of the American commitment in international affairs. This is an issue which the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and other members of the Senate have been trying to raise in the Senate, particularly over the last 18 months. The question can be resolved to, I suppose, three components. The first is, what really is the American commitment in many parts of the world? The second is, who has it to give? And where has it been given? And this, of course, covers the whole field, really, of our international responsibilities and obligations. In the hearings which we held this year on the Fulbright Resolution on Commitment, the administration spokesman was Mr. Katzenbach, who had formerly been the Attorney General. And I always hesitate to say I was shocked, but I was surprised at his testimony. We assumed that the administration would express some sympathy for the Congress and over the difficulty of our participating in foreign policy decisions. And they might say they hoped they could work out somewhat better relationships and perhaps even develop some kind of formal and institutional processes by which what we thought the Constitution very clearly intended, cooperation between the Senate particularly and the administration in developing foreign policy, could be more effectively worked out. Well, rather than that, the Undersecretary presented his view of the role of the Congress in foreign policy. And he had some rather interesting things to say. He said that the Constitution compelled the Congress to support the administration. This was new language to most of us and a new interpretation. He said we had power to distort and to obstruct the foreign policy of the president, which of course was true. But it was the negative presentation alone. He didn't say that we might have some kind of constructive powers and that we might occasionally, as I thought we did on the Test Ban Treaty and on one or two other issues in the recent years, make a constructive contribution to foreign policy. He said it was good when the Congress and the President agreed on foreign policy. It was more as a matter of convenience than a matter of anything required under the Constitution. And finally, he said that Thomas Jefferson supported his view. Well, that was too much for even our limited scholarship. We knew that Thomas Jefferson was on the side of the Congress and against a strong executive in the field of foreign policy. Well, our general commitments under treaty obligations are relatively limited, really, even 5 or 6 years after the end of World War II. We had, of course, entered into the NATO Treaty Organization, which was new in the history of this country, to project our nation, along with other nations, into a binding obligation of this kind, but it was obviously related to the war in which we had participated and followed from that. We went on from that to enter into the treaties that were related to the Organization of American States. This was not so revolutionary, since it was a kind of formalization, I suppose, of the Monroe Doctrine, with because of our great strength and power in the organization, leaving the really the preliminary and, of course, in every case, the ultimate determination of what we would do to the United States. And then we entered into the United Nations. In contrast with the kind of withdrawal and isolationism which characterized our attitude after World War I. And this is about where our formal obligations stood, with the exception of one or two minor treaties with on a country-by-country basis. The great expansion of our formal obligations came when John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State. He accepted a kind of general moral responsibility for the entire world to establish justice everywhere, to redress grievances, to spread democracy, and to establish order, and also to control communism. He was, I suppose, the greatest covenanter in history. And he proceeded as rapidly as he could to sign us up wherever anyone would sign. And where they wouldn't or didn't include us, we then endorsed what they had agreed to. The case of the CETO treaty arrangement, and then subsequent to that, CENTO, of which we were not a part, but which we endorsed. Then in a vague way, although he withdrew from the Geneva Conference, we stood apart. After it was over, we more or less assumed and continue to assume a rather full and even more than full responsibility for that. It was rumored that he had in mind to, at least had hoped to develop a treaty with some of the countries in Africa, so there would be a kind of encirclement or containment of whatever they were to contain in Africa. Question of which way it was to point, but in any case, his objective at that time seemed to be that, or to find first, some grouping of nations in Africa which he could sign up in some kind of common cause against other nations in Africa. We have something of it today, although it's not formal, in that we seem to take every other country across the northern tier of Africa. We are arming the Moroccans and the Russians, the Algerians. We are arming the Libyans and the Tunisians. The Russians are arming the Egyptians. We're arming Ethiopia, and the Russians are arming Somalia, each one taking a first choice and then yielding the next to the other country and then picking up again. It's been suggested that we'd do much better if we could just say, why don't we take two and you take two, because the chances then of border trouble, in which we would have to prove the superiority of our weapons, for example, over theirs would be reduced by approximately one half. And as has been said, we were fortunate that both India and Pakistan had been armed by the Western nations, because under those circumstances, there was no need to prove weapon superiority. You could let the issue be settled on some other basis and not have to reach back or forward to prove something about your technology or the level to which your military science had been advanced. Well, having, in a way, run out the treaty route, under Dulles, a new concept of responsibility, or for fixing responsibility, was developed, and that was presented in the Eisenhower Doctrine, known as the Middle East Doctrine, under which, if a nation were to invite us to come in and help, on the assumption that somehow this was directly or indirectly against communism, that we could respond. And so we were invited into Lebanon to settle what was a purely internal political problem, almost impossible to establish in any way that it was communist inspired. The same idea was more or less taken up and used in the preparation for the attempted invasion of Cuba, the idea being that a beachhead would be established, and at that point a government would be declared, and that government would then call upon us to come in and help control the populace in the countryside. And almost the same concept was operative as we attempted to deal with the problem of the Dominican Republic. The question of why we were called in and by whom was raised, and following that, a response on the grounds that there was danger of a communist takeover. In addition to these somewhat formal and somewhat less than formal approaches to commitment and obligation, or the assumption of obligation, there are several other devices, I won't call them devices, but ways in which we can become committed. One of these is the military assistance program, in which in some approximately 80 nations of the world, we do give military assistance. Oftentimes, it's simply military advice, a military aid group of some kind, representing our Department of Defense, is established to advise the military of the respective countries. Well, following that, of course, any kind of obligation can follow. We may have to go in to protect our military mission. We may have to provide troops to protect those who are protecting the military mission. In the debate on Vietnam, at one point, the Secretary of State said that he was giving many reasons, but one of the reasons he gave was that we had given economic aid and that Congress had approved that aid, and consequently, he said, this involved some kind of moral and continuing commitment to which we had to respond. So in all of these ways, by formal treaties, by informal invitation, by the fact of the presence of a military aid group or program, and also straining it somewhat, but at least as represented to us, the simple granting of economic aid might establish at least a kind of moral obligation and responsibility which we might undertake to fulfill by greater and greater commitments in the non-economic, in the military, and in the political and diplomatic area. Well, let us look particularly at Vietnam and raise these same questions. As to how we got there, as to who made the commitment, and as to what purpose the commitment was made. And as we approach it, I think that I would make this point, that this is a case in which it appears that our traditional means of becoming involved in foreign policy has been practically reversed. Traditionally, we have determined what our purpose is, what we wish to seek in some kind of foreign involvement, and following that, to commit our power in support of the purpose, or to determine what our ends are and our objectives, and then to proceed from that to decide upon the means and the methods and the measure of commitment that we think is proportionate or in order. But in the case of our recent involvement, not just in Vietnam, but in some other cases, the objectives, it seems, almost become a function of our power. The purposes we have, almost a product of our programming. The commitment oftentimes seems to arise after we are already engaged. And as has been said, oftentimes the flag follows the military instead of the military following the flag. Well, this may seem to be an overstatement, but it raises, I think, a kind of sign around which we are forced to analyze our general responsibilities around the world. Let us consider first where we were in fact and also in theory in Southeastern Asia in the year 1950. What were our physical commitments there, and what did we consider to be the nature of the obligations which we might have to accept? Well, I think the best presentation of both, the physical commitment, of course, is known to everyone, but the presentation of how we had analyzed our responsibilities there and how these responsibilities were accepted and defined, I think was best given in a speech by Dean Acheson in January of 1950. And I'd like to read certain excerpts from it as a starting point for a kind of analysis of how we got where we are today and what can be done about it. This was the famous speech which got attention because of the defense perimeter phrase which was included in it. And I suppose the fact that this was related to the war in Korea probably distracted people from giving attention to the substance of the message of that speech. For in it, he made other assessments of our responsibilities and of our place in the world, which were much more important, really, than the question of the defense perimeter. He talked, for example, about Russian moves against Outer Mongolia, Manchuria and Inner Mongolia, and Xinjiang, which the Soviet Union was then threatening to take back or to detach from China. He noted in this speech the reality and the rivalry and the potential conflict between China and Russia. And this is what he said. He said, all the efforts of propaganda will not be able to obscure it. The only thing that can obscure it is the folly of ill-conceived adventures on our part. The word adventures has been in the news recently, as some of you may have noted. Acheson used the word, admonishing us against it in 1950. And our part, he went on to say, which easily could do so. And I urge all who are thinking about these foolish adventures to remember that we must not seize the unenviable position which the Russians have carved out for themselves. We must not undertake to deflect from the Russians to ourselves the righteous anger and the wrath and the hatred of the Chinese people which must develop. It would be folly to deflect it to ourselves. We must take the position we have always taken, that anyone who violates the integrity of China is the enemy of China, and also, he said, is acting contrary to our own interests. That, he said, is the first great rule, and the greatest rule, in regard to the formulation of American policy towards Asia. Acheson spoke, of course, before the Sino-Soviet split had developed, and before the emergence of national communism as Asian communism, and when it was still viewed in Asia as simply an extension of Russian communism. And Acheson pronounced a second rule for American policy in Asia in that same speech. He said, the second rule is to keep our own purposes in Asia perfectly straight and perfectly pure and perfectly above board, and do not get them mixed up with legal quibbles or the attempt to do one thing and really achieve another. It is a mistake, he said, I think, in considering Pacific and Far Eastern problems to become obsessed with military considerations, important as they are. There are other problems that press, and these other problems are not capable of solution through military means. The other problems arise out of the susceptibility of many areas and many countries in the Pacific area to subversion and penetration. That cannot be stopped, he said, by military means. The susceptibility to penetration arises because in many areas there are new governments which have little experience in governmental administration and have not become firmly established or perhaps firmly accepted in their own countries. They grow in part from very serious economic problems and from great social upheaval. Secretary then went on to discuss the difference between our responsibilities in northern Pacific countries in the East, in Japan and Korea, where we had the opportunity to act and where he said we could be effective. But of Southeastern Asia, he had this to say. In the southerly part of the area, we are one of many nations who can do no more than help. The direct responsibility lies with the peoples concerned. They are proud of their new national responsibility. You can sit around in Washington or London or Paris or The Hague and determine what the policies are going to be in those areas. You cannot, he said. You can be willing to help, and you can help only when the conditions are right for help to be effective. That leads me, he said, to the other thing that I want to point out, and that is the limitation of effective American assistance in this area. American assistance, he said, can be effective when it is the missing component in a situation which might otherwise be solved. The United States cannot furnish all these components to solve the question. He said, the missing component. It cannot furnish determination. It cannot furnish the will. It cannot furnish the loyalty of the people to its government. But if the will and if the determination exists, if the people are behind their government, then, and not even always then, he said, is there a very good chance. In that situation, American help can be effective, and it can lead to an accomplishment which could not otherwise be achieved. All this, as we talk about nation building in South Vietnam and something now called revolutionary redevelopment, set against the warning that he sounded in 1950. Well, this was January. In March of 1950, and I don't know whether this is a significant date, but in any case, in that month, Dean Rusk became the Assistant Secretary for Far Eastern Affairs. And soon after that, he gave his first public speech with reference to China policy, the China Institute, in which he talked about the greedy hands of Russia reaching out for China and referred to China as a colonial government, a kind of Slavic Manchukuo, suggesting that this was entirely under the control of Russian communists. And of course, at that time, the fear of Russian communism, or at least the attempt to frighten us with Russian communism, was the popular line. This, the analysis we assume he made in 1951 with reference to China and the developments taking place within that country. Well, John Foster Dulles became Secretary of State after 1952. And we know more or less what his record was. He did not support the Geneva Accords, which were designed to neutralize Southeastern Asia. The CETO Treaty was his special effort, and two of the protocol countries of that refused to be protected by it, Cambodia in 1956 and Laos in 1962. Well, then we moved on to Vietnam. And the earliest beginnings of our involvement there are not known. Sometime we may find in the files, going back to the early years of the Eisenhower administration, some record of what was suggested and who was the prime mover and how they proposed to move, or perhaps in the files of the Pentagon or of the Central Intelligence Agency, someone sometime may put together the beginnings of this story. Most of us, of course, know the rumors about how Diem was found and how he was brought to the position of power. Whether those reports are true or not, I do not know. But in any case, we do know that from that beginning, there has been a gradual growth of physical and moral, I suppose one could say, commitment in South Vietnam. And I would summarize the stages in that escalation. Escalation, I suppose, has become the biggest word, really, in this war. Reminded of what George Orwell said in one of his essays on politics and the English language, written in, I think, about 1946. He said that what happens really in politics, that if you're in real trouble, he said it's good to find a Latin word. Well, I think we've known this in religion to some extent and have discovered that it doesn't really work out very well in the long run, but now that the disposition and the part of the church is to come away from it, Latin is becoming increasingly popular in the Pentagon. And I think Orwell said a mass of Latin words falls upon the facts like soft snow, blurring the outlines and covering up all of the details. So he went on to give one or two examples. Now this was in 1946 when we were pointing our finger at other nations. He said, defenseless villages are bombarded from the air, the inhabitants driven out into the countryside, the cattle are machine gunned, the huts set on fire with incendiaries. This is called pacification. Millions of peasants are robbed of their farms and sent trudging along the roads with no more than they can carry. This is called rectification of frontiers. Well, the word escalation is the strong word in explaining what's taking place in Vietnam. And always it's a word which has no point of interruption. It's always like it's too soon or too late. And by the time you raise the flag, it has passed by. Another word which is highly significant in this war is that of ratios, usually with reference to kill ratios, which are the only measurement, at least, that was being used for some time to determine whether we were succeeding or not. Since the old and established means of, at least of reporting victory or progress, had always been the capture of a town or the crossing of a river or the taking of a border, some kind of physical advance which could be measured and defined and reported. But in this war, the measurement of casualties, of deaths, and even more ominous, that of kill ratios as an indication of whether or not progress was being made. But in any case, after that first beginning, we have had a continuous escalation of the war. President Kennedy decided to increase the number of United States advisors above the 800 limit set by the Geneva Accords. At the time of his death, we had some 16,000 troops in, or military personnel in South Vietnam. In August of 1964, the Tonkin Gulf incident occurred, and this was followed by the congressional resolution. At the end of 64, we had only 23,000 troops in South Vietnam. Then in February of 65, the bombing of the North was initiated, allegedly in retaliation for guerrilla attacks on a U.S. outpost. By the end of that month, the report was that the bombing would continue, even though it was supposed to be in retaliation for guerrilla attacks, with these three objectives. First, to bring Hanoi to the conference table. Second, to raise the morale of the South Vietnamese. And third, to stop the movement of men and supplies from the North to the South. This, the full explanation for what was first presented as response to guerrilla attacks. In March of 65, the Marines landed in South Vietnam. In May, the first U.S. combat units, two Marine battalions, were in South Vietnam, and by June, the number of American military personnel had passed the 50,000 mark, with new movements announced going up to 70,000. In July of 1965, the real buildup began. By the end of that year, we had 185,000 military personnel in South Vietnam. At the end of January 1966, after a 37-day bombing pause, the attacks against the North were resumed and intensified. And by March, troop strength had reached 215,000. In April, B-52s from Guam struck North Vietnam for the first time. In June of 1966, American planes conducted the first of continuing attack on oil installations in the areas of Hanoi and Haiphong. In July, B-52 bombers initiated the first of a series of attacks on North Vietnamese troop concentrations in the area of the demilitarized zone. In December of 1966, U.S. troops were moved into the Mekong Delta area, where operations previously had been conducted solely by the South Vietnamese Army. By December, we were bombing closer and closer to the center of the city of Hanoi. It was confirmed that American troops were engaging in anti-guerrilla operations in Thailand. By the end of 1966, troop strength in South Vietnam had reached 385,000. In February of 1967, bombing was again resumed after a 6-day pause. And U.S. artillery in South Vietnam shelled North Vietnam for the first time. Naval bombardment began, and U.S. planes dropped mines into the rivers of North Vietnam. By March of this year, we admitted that we were using bases in Thailand for B-52 strikes against the South. In April, we began attacking North Vietnamese from these bases. In May, U.S. troops and South Vietnamese forces moved into the demilitarized zone between the two Vietnams, and by June, our troop strength was up to 463,000. Today, our troops number somewhat between 463 and 500,000. And almost every day, we see reports that a new target in North Vietnam has been taken from the prohibited list, until there is scarcely anything of military significance left that has not at least been made the object of a bombing attack or set up as a target. In addition, of course, there's the suggestion of terror tactics, of the devastation of the cities, of the bombing of dikes to flood the country, things that are talked about and perhaps planned for, proposed game of bombing closer and closer to the Russian ships in the harbor of Haiphong to see whether they can be encouraged to leave, and of course, the possibility of escalating by an invasion of North Vietnam, the early reports that South Vietnamese troops will be used, and following that, of course, we will probably have to support the South Vietnamese. And as this physical escalation has taken place, a greater and greater commitment of men and supplies and power, we've had at the same time a kind of escalation of the objectives. And I suppose that in a way this is more serious, in that when the physical commitment becomes too great for the objectives which we have set, we have to develop an objective which somehow compares or is proportionate to the material and physical effort that we're making. We cannot let one fall far behind the other. And we've seen this escalation of objectives almost parallel the increase of our firepower and of our manpower in South Vietnam. The early explanation was that really we were seeking only independence for South Vietnam. We moved on from that in 1965 to say we were fulfilling certain obligations that we had, building up a new kind of responsibility. In 1966, we began to take on the responsibility not just for the freedom of Vietnam, but for the building, if not the rebuilding. In the Honolulu Declaration, hunger and ignorance and disease, supposedly a kind of extension of our own Great Society program to South Vietnam. Then came the offering of the national honor, because the commitment by 1966, as we got up over 200,000 men, I don't know just what quantitative point is the point at which the national honor becomes involved, but in any case, this language began to creep into the statements coming out of the State Department. And the secretary then began to talk about how any change of policy would reflect upon what he called the credibility of our pledged word. More recently, in the press conference of October the 12th, the Secretary of State suggested that what we're concerned about is all of Southeastern Asia. This is not just independence and freedom for South Vietnam, but we have taken on the other countries of that area. And then he went on to suggest that we keep in mind the fact that there are or will be in another decade or two 1 billion Chinese, as he said, with nuclear weapons. When it was suggested that this was a kind of new version of the Yellow Peril, those who raised the question of his having raised the 1 billion Chinese were accused of some kind of racism, which I think is rather straining the figure of speech. In any case, this kind of parallel development of more men and more materials and a greater effort in the physical order, accompanied by an increasing escalation also of the objectives and the justifications for our being in Vietnam, has been the history of these last 4 years. And so we're called upon, it's late, but in any case, we're called upon in this coming year of 1968 particularly, to raise the basic questions about our involvement in Vietnam. The question of whether we're there legally or not, I think is relatively unimportant. Senator Morse makes a great case for the illegality of our involvement and points out that we have ignored the Geneva Convention and the agreements there and raises some other questions about the UN. The State Department makes a case saying that we are there legally under CETO and under other commitments. I think it's kind of a standoff. Usually at that point, why, the Tonkin Gulf Resolution is brought out and laid on the table, saying, here it is. I mean, this is why we're there, because the Congress passed the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, or at least this sustains our being there. And of course, the Tonkin Gulf resolution gave the president no power and no rights which he didn't have before it was passed. And it wouldn't have taken any away from him if we took it back. The president was quite right, I think, in what he said to a press conference about 2 months ago when he was explaining the deliberations that went into the presentation of this resolution. He said that we thought if it was passed, the Congress would be better informed. I don't know how that followed, but he said also, and it would keep them in place. Well, that, I think, was a proper consideration, because it was suggested to Harry Truman at the time of Korea that, at least I'm told so, that he send up a Korean resolution and have Congress pass it, because it was felt that if the Congress did so, that they would be less likely to be critical. And he supposedly said that it was his responsibility in Korea, and he was willing to take that responsibility, and if people wanted to criticize, why, they were free to do so. After that, it's been more or less customary whenever there's an international involvement of some kind to get a resolution to Congress very quickly in the hope that it was generally presented as an indication of public support for the position. But usually it works out as a device by which dissent and criticism can be discouraged. And certainly that has been the principal use of the Tonkin Gulf resolution. It's been more an instrument against the Senate than it has been one bearing upon the conduct of our foreign policy. The legal case is a mixed one, and I think that the realities are so powerful that arguing the legality or the illegality has become little more than an exercise. Well, what about the case from history? This is the case which is often made today, a kind of attempt to judge this in terms of some kind of historical analogy. And I know all of you here are aware of the limitations of historic analogy or comparisons as a basis for making a practical judgment, but also that there may be some lessons in it. And for the most part, the attempts to explain or to justify our being in South Vietnam are based upon some comparison to Munich. I sometimes think that history began for about half the people in the State Department with Munich, because and that if we could suggest to them that they might look beyond and into other civilizations and cultures, other lessons of the past, that this oversimplified analysis might be set aside, because it's so clear that the two situations are not comparable. The culture is different, the measure of unity is entirely different, the terrain is different, and of course there was no problem of colonialism involved in Europe as there was in Southeastern Asia. And even the comparison with Korea does not really stand up, because we had in South Korea a unified people who were willing, as we found, to defend themselves. Well, they then move on from this kind of analysis to a kind of historical projection, not looking back, but looking forward, a kind of prophetic act. And we do have in the Senate two or three prophets of some limited competence who can tell you what the world will be like 5 years from now or 10 years from now. Or we had one who used to tell us without much provocation what the majority of the people of Latin America, for example, were thinking. And there's something of this, I think, left in the State Department. We ought to go down and see if they don't have, in the manner of the Romans, people in the back room who are reading the natural signs, augurs and haruspicers and people of that kind who read the lightning and then come out and make the projection. But they do make projections. Say, if you don't do this, this is going to happen. This was the basis of the falling domino theory, which was popular for a while, but which has been dropped. The question of Chinese imperialism, the great drive of the Chinese, they can project that to you almost on a timetable. Asian communism and what it will do, even though it's not a success in China and hasn't been a success in Africa where they try to implant it, and certainly not in South America. And then to move on to the great threat to America and to the world. As the one senatorial candidate put it in Oregon last year, that if we didn't fight in the elephant grass of South Vietnam, we would fight in the rye grass of Oregon, Washington, and I assume California. Well, these great projections as to what will happen unless this particular action is sustained in Vietnam are part of the case which is being made for our commitment in Vietnam today. So we come finally to a kind of moral judgment, I think, on this, in which, insofar as we can, sorting out the facts and lining them up, we look to the reality. And I would not raise questions about the objectives that have been set for Vietnam or for our involvement there, because some of them are all right, and within limits, I suppose, each of them has some good in it. I think we can raise some serious questions about some of the methods and the instruments of war which we are using, but this comes to be a kind of balancing off and a kind of an endless argument. But finally, you can reduce the whole thing to the question of proportion, in which you say, is the amount of damage being done, the lives being lost, the material goods being destroyed, and the great waste of really of moral energy, is this any longer comparable to what may turn out to be a victory? In other words, what is the good in victory in comparison with the harm by which that victory may be achieved? And I would feel quite ready to withhold criticism if I could find anyone who is promoting the war or advocating it who could tell me what life would be like when victory is achieved in South Vietnam. And no one can. And so we must, I think, weigh these things in the balance, and in my judgment, when that balance is struck or the attempt is made to strike it, you find the case for the war sorely wanting. And that on really every basis of argument, military and historical and with some questions on the legality, but certainly on a moral basis, the continuation of the war is no longer justifiable. So we must first look to ways of preventing further escalation, and then to move on to ways and means by which the military effort, the violence, can be restricted. We could hope to some kind of acceptable, not ideal, settlement might be achieved. Now, I would conclude with turning to an historian writing about some experiences of mankind in earlier times, Arnold Toynbee, in his book on Hannibal's legacy, in which he studied the effect of the wars with Carthage on the Roman Republic. He said that the price of Rome's subjugation of the Western Mediterranean was the economic, social, and religious derangement of the Roman life. The government bent on pursuing military adventures on the frontiers became less and less responsive to domestic problems. And from this observation, he drew this conclusion. He said, war posthumously avenges the dead on the survivors and the vanquished on the victors. The nemesis of war is intrinsic. It did not need the invention of the atomic weapon to make this apparent. He said it was illustrated more than 2,000 years before our time by Hannibal's legacy to Rome. And I suggest that there's a great reason for us to pause and examine this lesson. For as in the distraction of this war, we are inclined to look away from domestic problems, to neglect them in some cases, but also to begin to neglect the other great problems that we have as a nation, a great and powerful nation, and its possible influence upon the course of history in this century and in the next.